Time now for this week's International Media, and joining me in the studio to break down the stories that are topping the headlines is Keith Boyford from London.
Good evening.
Good evening. And Mitchell Belfer from Rome.
Hello, thank you.
Both of you are research fellows at the Eurogolf Information Centre in Rome. Well, so now, 2 weeks after Britain's shock decision to leave the European Union, global markets are still reeling from the impact. What do you make of the coverage on Brexit's fallout? It does seem like Armageddon almost. Are the media overreacting? I don't know who wants to start.
Journalists are very excitable people, and they're always looking for a story. And actually, I think it has been hugely exaggerated by newspapers such as the Financial Times, which has really been mobilizing the Remain cause. And also The Economist has been very strongly pro-Remain, as has The Times. But interestingly, the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph have been great supporters, along with The Sun. They've been very strong supporters of the Brexit campaign. What the Brexit vote actually showed was that there's a huge disconnect between people living in London, where 60% were voting for Remain, along with Scotland, and the rest of the country. Once you get outside our version of the peripheric, the M25, there were 65% votes for Brexit. And the other thing was the age breakdown. A lot of people who are over 50 years old in Britain were voting Brexit. A lot of those over 50-year-olds are the readers of the Daily Telegraph. Two-thirds of the readers of the Daily Telegraph voted Brexit.
Would you say that there is a tug of war between the pro and anti-Europe camps being waged in the British press?
Yes, The Guardian would really like to have a second referendum and would like to see Parliament actually vote out any adoption of actually of people taking notice of the Brexit vote.
Of course. Well, Mitchell, I understand you are very much pro-European. Are you of the opinion of The Guardian for a second referendum? Would you like to see the Brits go back to the polls and make a different decision, perhaps the right one this time?
No, I don't think that a second referendum is the answer. Actually, we've seen it in the past with European referendums. That's just because a government or a segment of society is not happy with the result doesn't mean that you have to just keep trying and trying and trying again. But my
although the European Union were very keen on that in the case of Dublin. When they got the answer wrong first time, they simply held another vote.
But it was a much more ambiguous question that was asked in the referendum.
And just remind us what was at stake?
The Lisbon Treaty, in fact. In that referendum, in the Irish referendum, it was about the future. It was basically the constitution, reformed constitution of the European Union. But from my point of view, I think it's important to realise that there are some costs that are involved in Brexit that in the United Kingdom people don't really see, because they see it as a debate internally. But for many Europeans, they see it as an abandonment of some, in some ways, of the European project. And what you have clearly seen in the European press is that the right wing has been completely galvanized by Britain's decision. And as a result of that, you're having these new kind of mechanisms and pressures that are kind of unfolding on the political scenes, and much more fragile political scenes, by the way, and economic scenes within Central and Eastern European countries.
But I think Mitchell's touched on a very important point, because I've been saying for about 6 months now that you might see a domino effect. The very fact that so many people have been surprised by the Brexit vote in Britain, it shows people across Europe that they can reassess their relationship with Brussels. And I think this is a wholly constructive and positive thing, because you might well find that there will be a central core of member states who decide to move towards ever closer union.
So you're saying on the one hand there is a clear domino effect of other countries calling for possible referendums in their,
beginning
in their
to
own
see it
countries.
In places like Hungary, Italy,
even in France.
Marine Le Pen is very keen on that idea.
But at the same time, we are sort of seeing in media outlets like Euractiv and Euronews that there is a willingness to better explain what the European model is.
Well, they've not made a very good job at it, despite all the money they've thrown at it over the last 20 years.
But perhaps it's now dawning on them that now is the right time to better clarify what Europe is for the general public. So on that point, I turn again to Mitchell. Would you say that the coverage of Europe now is becoming more positive.
No, actually not at all. And this is where I'd also disagree a little bit with what Keith was saying before. Well, he actually touched on it. Marine Le Pen is the one who's now saying, let's have this referendum in France, but she's not exactly the role model that we're looking for when it comes to European integration. The other thing that we have to consider is that it's not only an economic union. It's a political statement, a post-World War II, and especially for the Central and East European countries, it's also a post-Cold War statement. And I think that those countries are very fragile, and there's a responsibility that Britain has to sell its story in a better way so that it doesn't seem like it's abandoning those countries either economically or politically, and especially at a time of increased Russian pressure coming from the East in security terms.
Your president, Miloš Zeman, has called for a referendum on the Czech Republic's membership in the EU and NATO. What's your view?
If the Czech Republic leaves NATO, you have just punched a hole in the architecture of security that we've been building on for 25 years. And that is an open invitation for Russian, continued Russian influence, but also for countries to start pursuing conflicting foreign policies.
Well, turning our attention elsewhere now. Coverage this week has also been dominated by the findings of the Chilcot inquiry, and it's issued very damning criticism of the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Firstly, you know, your reactions to this story and how you think it's been covered by the media.
Well, I think that it has taken 7 long years to produce this report at vast expense. And in some ways, it's the most tremendous waste of money. Yeah. It's actually not told us anything, as far as I can see from the headlines, that we didn't know already. But actually, I think it's going to have very little impact on British public opinion because they've already decided about Tony Blair. Tony Blair now has to go around Britain with a large personal security staff because he's in danger of people taking out a citizen's arrest over his behaviour on Iraq.
Your view, Mitchell?
Yeah, I think that, to echo Keith, we're not going to learn anything new in this inquiry. And I think that we also have to put everything into a geopolitical context. And Tony Blair was not the decision maker to go to war. And Tony Blair and Britain would not have gone to war as the lead actor. It was following their allies of the United States. But I do want to point out something that when it comes to Iraq, that the report is not going to address, which is the geopolitics of the region. And I'm not sure that we'd be having this discussion had the aftermath of the conflict been more stable in Iraq and subsequently in the rest of the region and in Syria. And here it should really be noted that, again, the United Kingdom was not the lead actor here, but certainly they didn't have a strong enough security policy in relation to the areas under their control, like in the areas of southern Iraq in and around the city of Basra. And it's from those places in Basra and also in the areas around Baghdad, in the Shia suburbs of Baghdad, that many of the, let's say, the militias had arisen, which ultimately challenged the authority of the government in Baghdad.
Okay, just to finish, because we're on a very tight deadline, Ramadan has been celebrated by hundreds of Muslims around the world, but this year celebrations have been marred by a wave of violence in many Muslim countries. My question to you, too, is do you have a sense that the media, when they talk about Muslims, they always relate to Islam through the prism of terrorism?
I wouldn't say that that's necessarily accurate year on year. This year has been particularly hard because ISIS is, and the war against ISIS in both Syria and Iraq is in some ways, at least on the territorial front, is winding down. And ISIS is responding through acts of terrorism and gross violence, in fact, against not only those countries, but basically on a worldwide scale. But there is, in the last years, a very clear media focus on the relationship between Islam as a religion, countries of Muslim majority, and also on acts of terrorism. And I think that these narratives need to be challenged because, I mean, they're fundamentally flawed and they make gross over-exaggerations of things. I mean,
a bit like Tony Blair with the Chilcot inquiry.
Yeah, but also
in different context.
Exactly, different context. But especially, you know, a country like Saudi Arabia, you know, you talk to people, or 9 out of 10 people in Europe are going to tell you that Saudi Arabia is a sponsor of terrorism. It's not a sponsor of ISIS. It's not a sponsor of Al-Qaeda. Those organizations have focused on undermining the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the first line of defense against them in some ways.
Okay. But there's also a role for political leaders such as the new mayor of London, who is a Muslim himself, to actually put the case for greater understanding. And I think that the new mayor has done a very good job in that regard.
Okay, well, that's unfortunately all we have time for in this week's International Media. So a big thanks to my special guests, Keith Boyford and Mitchell Belfer from the Eurogolf Information Centre. Thank you for joining us at RFI. And until next time, keep listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.